Chapter 10. Fast, Slow, and Not at All. 800,000 commuters make their way down Paulista Avenue every day, and it shows. The lanes are gridlocked with compact cars and dented scooters. The sidewalks are a rushing river of men in candy-colored dress shirts and women carrying on intense speakerphone conversations. Between them, gaggles of schoolgirls walk by wearing t-shirts their parents certainly didn't translate into English. I give zero fucks, porn freak, and I got zero chill in me. Every few blocks, there's a newsstand selling the requisite Cosmopolitan and Playboy, but also Nietzsche and Trotsky manifestos, along with collections of Charles Bukowski's dirty poetry. More honks, a screech of wheels, someone yells something to someone, the light turns green, and we all make our way across the vast intersection, deeper into a canyon of mirrored buildings. I've come here to downtown Sao Paulo, Brazil, to meet with a renowned expert on the foundations of yoga, a man named Luiz Sergio Alvarez de Rose. The yoga de Rose studies and teaches is an ancient practice, vastly different from the yoga at neighborhood studios. It was developed before yoga was even called yoga, before it was an aerobic exercise or had any spiritual connotations, at a time when it was a technology of breathing and thinking. I've come to meet with de Rose because after all this research, after so many years of reading books and talking to experts, I've still got questions. First up, I want to know why the body heats up during Tummo and other breathing plus practices. The heavy dose of stress hormones could blunt the pain of cold, but it couldn't stop damage to the skin, tissues, and the rest of the body. Nobody knows how Maurice Debar, Wim Hof, and their followers can sit naked in the snow for hours and not get hypothermia or frostbite. Even more confounding are the monks. They practice a mellower version of Tummo that stimulates the opposite physiological response. These monks don't huff and puff. Instead, they sit cross-legged and breathe slow and less, inducing a state of extreme relaxation while reducing their metabolic rates by as much as 64%, the lowest number recorded in lab experiments. These people should be dead, or at least suffering from extreme hypothermia. However, in this relaxed state, they're able to increase body temperature by double digits and stay steaming hot in freezing temperatures for hours. Another question that's been baffling me is how heavy breathing plus techniques like holotropic breathwork can provoke such wild hallucinations. After 15 minutes of conscious overbreathing, the brain starts to compensate. In several studies, there appeared to be no oxygen deprivation after that initial hit. All cognitive function should be normal, but they are certainly not. Researchers in the U.S. and Europe have spent decades sticking nodes and probes into people trying to understand the hidden mechanism behind these methods. Nobody has found it. Nobody can explain it. So I've decided to look backwards to the ancient texts of the Indians. Every technique I've studied and practiced over the past decade, from coherent breathing to buteyko, staus, exhalations to breath holding, they all first appeared in ancient texts. The scholars who wrote them clearly knew that breathing is more than just ingesting oxygen and expelling CO2. Our breath also contained another invisible energy, more powerful and affecting than any molecule ever discovered. De Rose knows all about it. He's written 30 books on the oldest forms of yoga and breathing. He's been decorated with every royal decree imaginable in Brazil, including Emeritus Advisor of the Order of Parliamentarians, Grand Officer of the Order of the Noble Knights of Sao Paulo, and dozens more. These were decorations normally reserved for great statespeople. De Rose has them all, even something called a Great Necklace of the Order of Merit from the East Indies. And now, as I cross over from Paulista onto Rua Belisintra, he is only a few blocks away. Open up a book or website or Instagram feed on yoga, and chances are you'll see the word prana, which translates to life force or vital energy. Prana is basically an ancient theory of atoms. The concrete in your driveway, the clothes on your body, that spouse now clanking dishes in your kitchen, they're all made of swirling atomic bits. It's energy. It's prana. The concept of prana was first documented around the same time in India and China, some 3,000 years ago, and became the bedrock of medicine. The Chinese called it qi and believed the body contained channels that functioned like prana power lines connecting organs. The Japanese had their own name for prana. They called it ki. The Greeks called it pneuma, the Hebrews ruah, Iroquois arinda, and so on. Different names, same premise. The more prana something has, the more alive it is. Should its flow ever become blocked, the body would shut down and sickness would follow. If we lose so much prana that we can't support basic bodily functions, we'll die. Over the millennia, cultures developed hundreds, even thousands of methods to maintain a steady flow of prana. They created acupuncture to open it up, and yoga postures to awaken and distribute it. Spicy foods contained large doses of prana, which is one of the reasons traditional Indian and Chinese diets are so hot. But the most powerful technique was to inhale prana, to breathe. Breathing practices were so fundamental to prana that qi, ruah, and other terms for energy are synonymous with respiration. When we breathe, we expand our life force. The Chinese called their system of breathing qigong. Qi meaning breath and gong meaning work, or put together, breathwork. Through the past several centuries of medical advancements, Western science never observed prana or even confirmed that it exists. But in 1970, a group of physicists took a stab at measuring its effects when a man named Swami Rama walked into the Menninger Clinic in Topeka, Kansas, the largest psychiatric training center in its day. Rama was wearing a flowing white robe, a bead necklace, and sandals with hair that drooped down past his shoulders. He spoke 11 languages, ate mostly fruits and nuts, and claimed to have hardly any material possessions. At 6 feet 1 inch and 170 pounds, and with a lot of energy for debate and persuasion, he was a formidable figure, wrote one staff member. By the age of 3, Rama was practicing yoga and breathing techniques around his home in northern India. He later moved to Himalayan monasteries and studied secret methods alongside Mahatma Gandhi and other Eastern luminaries. In his 20s, he headed west to attend Oxford and eventually set off around the world to teach the methods he'd learned to anyone who cared to listen. In the spring of 1970, Rama was sitting at a wooden desk in a small, pictureless office at the Menninger Clinic. He had sensors over his heart and forehead. Dr. Elmer Green stood above him, inspecting the equipment through Coke bottle glasses. A former Navy weapons physicist, Green headed the Voluntary Controls Program, a lab within the clinic that investigated something called psychophysiologic self-regulation. Green had heard about the extraordinary abilities of Indian meditators from his colleagues and had even seen data from a recent experiment with Rama at a VA hospital in Minnesota. Green wanted to confirm the results with the latest instruments. He wanted to observe the power of prana for himself. Rama exhaled, lowered his thick eyelids, and then began breathing, carefully controlling the air entering and exiting his body. The lines on the EEG readout grew longer and softer, from hyperactive beta to calming and meditative alpha, and then to long and low delta, the waves identified with deep sleep. Rama stayed in this comatose state for about a half hour. He became so relaxed that at one point he began gently snoring. When he woke up, he gave a detailed recap of the conversation in the room that had occurred while he was displaying a brain state of deep sleep. But Rama didn't call it deep sleep. He called it yogic sleep, where the mind was active while the brain was unconscious. In the next experiment, Rama shifted his focus from his head to his heart. He sat motionless, breathed a few times, and then, when given a signal, slowed his heart rate from 74 to 52 beats a minute. Later, he increased his heart rate from 60 to 82 beats within 8 seconds. At one point, Rama's heart rate went to zero and stayed there. Green thought Rama had shut off his heart completely, but upon closer inspection, he found that Rama had commanded it to tremble at 300 beats per minute. Blood can't move through the chambers of the heart when it pumps this fast. For this reason, the phenomenon called atrial flutter usually results in cardiac arrest and death. Rama, however, was unaffected. He claimed that he could maintain this state for a half hour. The results of the experiment were later reported in the New York Times. Rama went on to shift the prana, or the blood flow, or both, to other parts of his body, willing it from one side of his hand to the other. Within 15 minutes, he was able to create a temperature difference of 11 degrees between his little finger and thumb. His hands never moved. Oxygen, carbon dioxide, and hormones played no part in Rama's abilities. As far as is known, his blood gases and nervous system were normal throughout each of the experiments. There was some other strange force at play, some more subtle energy he'd harnessed. Dr. Green and the Menninger team knew it was there. They'd measured its effects on Rama's body and brain. They just had no way to calculate it with any of their machines. By the early 1970s, Swami Rama had become a bona fide breathing superstar, with his bushy eyebrows and laser beam eyes showing up in Time, Playboy, Esquire, and later on the daytime television talk show circuit, including Donahue. Nobody in the Western world had seen anything like him. But it turned out Rama wasn't that special. A French cardiologist 40 years earlier had recorded a yogi doing the exact same thing, stopping and starting his heart on demand. A researcher from the University of California, Los Angeles, repeated the test and found yogis who could not only control the beat of their hearts, but also the flow of sweat and the temperature of their fingertips. Swami Rama's superhuman abilities weren't superhuman at all. They'd been standard practice for generations of Indian yogis. Rama revealed some of his secrets of prana control in group lessons and videos. He recommended students begin by harmonizing their breathing, by removing the pause between inhalations and exhalations so that every breath was one line connected with no end. When this practice felt comfortable, he instructed them to lengthen the breaths with a goal of reaching a half minute. Anyone who mastered this, Rama promised, quote, will not have any toxins and will be disease-free. Infusing the body with prana is simple. You just breathe. But controlling this energy and directing it took a while. Rama obviously had learned something much more powerful in the Himalayas, but as far as I could tell from his books and videos, he never elaborated. The best possible explanation I could find on what the vital substance of prana might be and how it might work came not from a yogi, but from a Hungarian scientist who nearly flunked out of school as a kid, shot himself in the arm to get out of serving in World War I, and later earned a Nobel Prize for groundbreaking work on vitamin C. His name was Albert Svent Georgi. And in the 1940s, he'd made his way to the United States and would end up heading the National Foundation for Cancer Research. It was there, working in a lab in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, that he proposed an explanation for the subtle energy that drives all life. He wrote, "All living organisms are but leaves on the same tree of life. The various functions of plants and animals and their specialized organs are manifestations of the same living matter." Svetgyorgy wanted to understand the process of breathing, but not in the physical or mental sense. He wanted to understand it at the subatomic level. He wanted to know how life gained energy from air. Everything around us is composed of molecules, which are composed of atoms, which are composed of subatomic bits called protons, neutrons, and electrons. All matter is, at its most basic level, energy. What distinguishes inanimate objects like rocks from birds and bees and leaves is the level of energy or the excitability of electrons within those atoms that make up all those molecules. The more easily and often electrons can be transferred, the more desaturated matter becomes, the more alive it is. Svetgyorgy studied the earliest life forms on Earth and deduced that they were all made up of weak electron acceptors, which meant they couldn't easily take in or release electrons. He argued that this matter had less energy, so it had less chance to evolve. It just stayed there, mucking around without ever doing much for millions and millions of years. Eventually, oxygen, the byproduct of all that muck, accumulated in the atmosphere. Oxygen was a strong electron acceptor. As new muck evolved and consumed more and more oxygen, it was able to attract and exchange more electrons. With the surplus of energy, early life evolved rather quickly into plants, insects, and us. "The living state is such an electronically desaturated state," wrote Svetgyorgy. "Nature is simple but subtle." This premise can be applied to life on the planet today. The more oxygen life can consume, the more electron excitability it gains, the more animated it becomes. When living matter is bristling and able to absorb and transfer electrons in a controlled way, it remains healthy. When cells lose this ability, they break down. This is what causes metals to rust and leaves to turn brown and die. Humans rust as well. As the cells in our bodies lose the ability to attract oxygen, electrons within them will slow and stop freely interchanging with other cells, resulting in unregulated and abnormal growth. Tissues will begin rusting in much the same way as other materials. But we don't call this tissue rust. We call it cancer. And this helps explain why cancers develop and thrive in environments of low oxygen. The best way to keep the body healthy was to mimic the reactions that evolved in early aerobic life, to flood our bodies with a constant presence of that strong electron acceptor, oxygen. We can do this by breathing slow, less, and through the nose. These simple techniques help send the maximum amount of O2 to the maximum amount of tissues, so that our cells have the maximum amount of electron reactivity. Svetgyorgy wrote, "In every culture and in every medical tradition before ours, healing was accomplished by moving energy." This moving energy of electrons allowed living things to stay alive and healthy for as long as possible. The names may have changed over the millennia. Prana, Orinda, Chi, Rua, atoms, electrons, but the principle has remained the same. Svetgyorgy apparently took his own advice. He died in 1986 at the age of 93. A knock, a swing of the door, a few exchange bom dias, and I take a seat in a lobby of a reception area of DeRosa's studio. There are wood floors and puffy sofas, white walls and world maps. A sign at the center of the room reads, "Stop and breathe." A group of DeRose teachers and students are lounging and giggling in Portuguese at the center of the lobby. Hedwan Pinheiro is one of them. He's wearing white pants and resembles a 1980s teen star. Pinheiro has graciously offered to take time away from his busy schedule operating two DeRose studios to be my guide and translator. We walk through the reception area and up a dark staircase to meet the man he calls the Master. The office is small and decorated with medals and silver swords, each emblazoned with the kinds of Masonic pyramids and eyeballs you see on dollar bills in old buildings. "They just give me these things. I don't know why," says DeRose, vigorously shaking my hand. He's powerfully built, with a neatly trimmed beard and wide brown eyes. The shelves behind him are filled with copies of the books he's sold by the millions on subjects like pranayama, karma, and ancient yoga. I've read a few of them and found no surprises, no secret breathing method I hadn't already known about or tried in the past few years. This wasn't surprising either. The history of yoga and the earliest breathing techniques is long established. But now, finally here, I'm eager to compare notes with DeRose. I'm eager to see what he knows about prana and the lost art and science of breathing that I do not. "Shall we begin?" he says. If you were to travel back in time some 5,000 years to the borders of what is now Afghanistan and northwestern India, you'd see a lot of sand, rocky mountains, dusty trees, and wide open plains. You'd also find something else. 5 million people living in cities of baked brick houses, roads meticulously constructed in geometric patterns, and children playing with copper, bronze, and tin toys. Between the cul-de-sacs, you'd see public bathing pools with running water and toilets piped to complex sanitation systems. In the marketplace, you'd see tradespeople measuring goods with weights and rulers, sculptors carving figures into stone, and ceramists throwing pots and tablets. This was the Indus Valley culture, named after the river that flowed through it. It was the largest geographically and most advanced of ancient human civilizations. As far as is known, the Indus Valley had no churches or temples or sacred spaces. The people who lived there produced no praying sculptures or iconography. Palaces, castles, and imposing governmental buildings didn't exist. There was perhaps no belief in God. But the people here believed in something else. They believed in the power of breathing. A seal engraving unearthed from the civilization in the 1920s depicts a man in an unmistakable pose. He's sitting erect with his arms outstretched and hands placed on his knees. His legs are crossed and the soles of his feet are joined. His belly is filled with air as he consciously inhales. Several other unearthed figures share the same posture. These artifacts are the first documented yogic poses in human history. Which makes sense. The Indus Valley was the birthplace of yoga. Things seemed to be going so well in the region until around 2000 BC when a drought hit, causing much of the population to disperse. Then Aryans from the northwest moved in. These weren't the blonde-haired, blue-eyed soldiers of Nazi lore, but black-haired barbarians from Iran. The Aryans took the Indus culture, codified it, condensed it, and rewrote it in their native language of Sanskrit. It's from these Sanskrit translations that we get the Vedas, religious texts that contain the earliest known documentation of the word yoga. In two of them are the earliest lessons of breathing and the control of prana. Over the next few thousand years, the breathing methods spread throughout India, China, and beyond. By around 500 BC, the techniques would be filtered and synthesized into the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali. Slow breathing, breath holding, deep breathing into the diaphragm, and extended exhalations, all of these techniques first appear in this ancient text. A broad interpretation of passage 2.51 reads, "When a wave comes, it washes over you and runs up the beach. Then the wave turns around and recedes over you, going back to the ocean. This is like the breath, which exhales, transitions, inhales, transitions, and then starts the process again." There's no mention in the Yoga Sutras of moving between or even repeating poses. The Sanskrit word asana originally meant seat or posture. It referred both to the act of sitting and the material you sit on. What it specifically did not mean was to stand up and move about. The earliest yoga was a science of holding still and breathing. DeRose got a taste for this kind of ancient yoga in the 1970s when he was traveling through India trying to piece together the practices of the Indus Valley. He attended a class in the foothills of the Himalayas. The studio was very basic, with a dirt floor and filled with villagers seeking to keep themselves warm during cold days. The classes were casual. Teachers joked with students, students joked back. "Push yourself," the instructors would yell in gruff and direct voices. "You can do better than that." DeRose would recall that there were no, quote, gymnastics, anti-gymnastics, bioenergetics, occultism, spiritism, zen, dance, body expression, macrobiotics, shiatsu. Poses were done once and held for an excruciatingly long time. These long postures allowed students to focus entirely on their breathing. The class was difficult, and at the end of it, DeRose was sweaty and sore. "Nothing like yoga today," he says from across the desk. He tells me that only in the 20th century would yoga poses be combined and repeated into a kind of aerobic dance called vinyasa flow. It's this form of yoga and other hybridized techniques that are now taught in gyms, studios, and classrooms. Ancient yoga and its focus on prana, sitting, and breathing has turned into a form of aerobic exercise. This isn't to say modern yoga is bad in any way. It's simply a different practice from the one that originated 5,000 years ago. An estimated 2 billion people now practice this modern form because it makes them feel better and look better and stay more flexible in all the ways stretching and exercise does. Hundreds of studies have confirmed the healing benefits of asanas, standing up and otherwise. But what have we lost? Toward the end of our hours-long meeting, I tell DeRose about my experience in that Victorian house 10 years ago, how I had practiced an ancient pranayama technique called Sudarshan Kriya, and how it completely floored me. I tell him how a mellower version of that reaction keeps happening to me, and how it keeps happening to millions of others whenever we use traditional yogic breathing. Versions of Kriya have been around since 400 BC, and by some accounts were used by everyone from Krishna to Jesus Christ. The Kriya I'd experienced was developed in the 1980s by a man named Sri Sri Ravi Shankar. Tens of millions of people around the world now practice it through the Art of Living Foundation. It does much of what Tummo does, blunting stress, healing autoimmune disease, and all the rest. Sudarshan Kriya 2 was no picnic. The central method, called purifying breath, requires more than 40 minutes of intense breathing, from huffing at a rate of 100 breaths per minute to several minutes of slow breathing and then little breathing at all. Rinse and repeat. I tell DeRose about the extreme sweating, complete loss of time and lightness I felt for days after my first experience. How I'd spent the last decade looking for an explanation, conducting various lab experiments and analyzing my blood gases, scanning my brain. He sits calmly with his hands neatly folded. He's heard this all so many times before. I'd found nothing in these readouts or scientific measurements because, he says, I've been looking in the wrong place. It's energy. It's prana. What happened was simple and common. I'd built up too much prana, breathing so heavily for so long, but I hadn't yet adapted to it. This explained the waterworks and the shift of consciousness. Sudarshan is derived from two words, su meaning good and darshan meaning vision. In my case, I'd had a very good vision. Ancient yogis spent thousands of years honing pranayama techniques specifically to control this energy and distribute it through their bodies. This process took several months or years to master. Modern breathers like me could try to hack it and speed it up, but we would fail. Hallucinations, howling, soiling one's clothes, none of it was supposed to happen. It's a sign we've gone overboard. The key to Kriya, Tummo, and any other breathing practice rooted in ancient yoga is to learn to be patient, maintain flexibility, and slowly absorb what breathing has to offer. My initial experience so many years ago may have been a bit jarring, but DeRose says it also convinced me of the sheer power of breathing. In the end, it's what brought me here. After a few more rounds of Q&A, and it's time for me to go. DeRose needs to pack his things and head back to New York, where his colleagues run two bustling studios in Tribeca and Greenwich Village. Meanwhile, I need to catch a 17-hour flight back home. We exchange a few obrigados, shake hands, and I follow Pinheiro, my translator, past the glinting swords and red ribbons into the dark hallway. Before I leave, Pinheiro has offered to teach me some of the ancient yoga breathing techniques DeRose has dug up over his decades of research. We hike up to the third floor, take off our shoes, and step into a studio. This room is no different from any other yoga studio I've seen. There's that blue padding on the floor, wall-wide mirrors, and Sanskrit posters. Pinheiro kneels cross-legged so that his body is centered between the windows, casting a Buddha shadow. I take a seat across from him, and a minute later, we begin to breathe. We start with Jiha Pranayama, which involves curling the tongue to the back of the mouth and holding the breath. Then I lie down in front of him so that I'm looking up at the ceiling. The final exercise I'll be doing is intended to build prana in the body and focus the mind. Concentrate on just one fluid movement from inhale to exhale, says Pinheiro. These are the same instructions I'd heard in that Kriya session way back when, the same instructions I'd learned from Anders Olsen years later, and from that Wim Hof instructor, Chuck McGee. I know this process now. I know the ropes. I relax my throat, take a very deep inhale into the pit of my stomach. Then I exhale completely. There it is again. And here I am again. The ringing in the ears, the heavy metal bass drum thumping in my chest, the warm static flowing in my shoulders and face. The wave comes, washes over, and runs up, then turns around and recedes, back to the ocean. I've felt this all before so many times. It's the same thing the ancient people of the Indus Valley experienced 5,000 years ago, and the ancient Chinese 2,000 years after them. Alexandra David Neal warmed herself with it in a cave in the Himalayas, and Swami Rama focused it on his hands and heart. Buteyko rediscovered it in a window in the asthma ward, and Carl Stau taught it to dying veterans. As I breathe a little faster and go a little deeper, the names of all those techniques I've explored over the past 10 years all come back in a rush. Pranayama, coherent breathing, hypoventilation, breathing coordination, holotropic breathwork, adhama, midyama, uttama, embryonic breath, harmonizing breath, the breath of the master great nothing, tummo, and kriya. The names may have changed over the years, the techniques may have been repurposed and repackaged in different cultures at different times for different reasons, but they were never lost. They've been inside us all this time, just waiting to be tapped. They give us the means to stretch our lungs and straighten our bodies, boost blood flow, balance our brains, and excite the electrons in our molecules. To sleep better, run faster, swim deeper, live longer, and evolve further. They offer a mystery and magic of life that unfolds a little more with every breath we take.